From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on June 21st, the night of the Democratic primary debate for the 25th Congressional District. Four candidates debated the various issues facing their district and our country. Rochester City Councilman Adam McFadden addressed questions about gun violence by making an impassioned case about the need for more than just new laws. He talked about his friend Lamont Howard, stabbed to death in downtown Rochester when he was 14 years old. He talked about a store owner named Jerry Foster, killed inside his store. He talked about Tyrone Smith, a friend who joined the Navy and was shot on the dance floor when he was enjoying a night out. McFadden told the audience that the issue of violence, it's not about laws. It's about respect for life, and it's about understanding trauma and trauma-informed care. And McFadden said that if we don't understand the impact of trauma, we will not fix this problem. We asked the councilman to join us on Connections to discuss this issue at length, and he's here today to do that. Thanks for taking the time. It's good to see you again.
Same here.
I want to start just by listening. I mean, it's going to be strange. You're here, but I want to listen to what you said that night, because I have to admit that moderating that debate, that was the moment that kind of gripped everybody. You could hear a pin drop in that studio as Adam talked about losing his friends and then had this to say. Let's listen.
Boss. People go to prison after they kill folks. They know that there's a possibility when they kill someone that they're going to go to prison. This is about trauma-informed care. We have a lot of people who are traumatized in our community, who do not have love in their heart, who do not respect life. We keep talking about this as if we're going to get all the magical guns off the street and all of a sudden murders will stop. Well, my friend was stabbed to death when I was 14. I've lived this experience over and over again. I've responded to so many homicides in this city. I've led rallies and marches. I've turned in murderers. We cannot legislate this. We have a people problem. We have a problem with the fact that we have folks that don't have love in their heart and don't have a respect for life, that when they find conflict, that they decide to take a life, no matter what the consequence is at the end of that, whether they go to prison or don't get caught, they don't care. So we as elected officials, we keep doing this dance about laws. This is about people and their hearts. It's not about race. It's not about money. This is about trauma. And if we don't do a better job of identifying that, we'll never fix this problem.
I thought that was remarkable. The reason we invited Adam is because I think there's so much to talk about there. And we heard from some listeners who were moved by it, but wanted to hear more about the trauma aspect vis-a-vis gun laws. So let's kind of work through some of that here. You think about your own friends and your own experience. You have lost a lot of people.
Absolutely. And you know, I named three, but I can name probably a dozen. And that night, it's funny. Sometimes when you go into debates, you have scripted things that you want to say, but that wasn't scripted. That just came from the heart. It's something that many of us in my community have lived with. You just think about it. I've been shot, you know, as a teenager, and had the bullet not hit me in the leg and maybe hit me somewhere else. You know, I may not be here to do this show. The folks that I know that have participated either in gun violence, homicides, all of them were aware of the consequences of what happens when you take a life. And most of them didn't have remorse until they got caught and had to go to prison. I, you know, serving in politics for almost 15 years now, have struggled with the fact that as elected officials, we get the pressure to do something. And sometimes we act knowing that the action that we're getting ready to put forward isn't going to do much. It makes people feel good. It makes people think that we're really working on the problem, when in all actuality, we have people in our community that have been traumatized and are playing out that pain on other people. And we have not dealt with that. And that is not, in my mind, a government problem. That is a problem that we all face as people. Growing up, I was traumatized. I had a lot of issues with anger, a lot of issues with having a temper. But as I became a young man, luckily enough, I had people in my life that showed me how to channel that energy into other things. And to this day, as a 47-year-old man, I know it's still there, but I don't play out on it. And so dealing with that and facing that, knowing that, it's hard for me to accept, hey, we need more laws in the books.
Adam, when you think about the laws that we pass to try to sort of tell the public you've done something, is the SAFE Act an example? Are there other that come to mind for you?
I think there's some validity to the SAFE Act in terms of capacity of magazine rounds and background checks. I don't have a problem with that. But I don't want people thinking that because we passed a law, we've fixed people. We haven't. We haven't. And matter of fact, when you think about things like trauma-informed care, that's really a new practice in our community with young people. But we still haven't passed that on to adults. There are a number of adults, people who are in their 20s, 30s, 40s, who have faced some traumatic experiences in their life that have not dealt with that appropriately, and it plays out. So when you get a 50-something-year-old man killing a woman that's 101 years old, well, what happened in his life to make him think that that would be okay?
Yeah, I certainly take the point. Well, let me ask you about what one of your colleagues, Willie Lightfoot, was on this program last week. They rolled out a new campaign. They're calling it Think About It, and there will be billboards, signs, literature, conversations, imploring people in our community who may have access to guns to think about the permanent consequences. And if we could, I'd like to listen to some of Willie's comments a week ago on this program. I asked him, you know, there have been a lot of ideas over the years about dealing with gun violence. What do you think this is different? Here's what Willie said.
I think this is different, first and foremost, because it's a grassroots effort. This isn't coming from corporate America down to the public. This is actually coming from the public to everyone. And the unique ways that we'll be utilizing and putting out this campaign through the barbershops, the salons, restaurants, utilizing local businesses, as well as people and partners that work in this every day.
You think he's got a point?
I do. I think if we're having the conversations to be aware of our actions at the grassroots levels. At the grassroots level, I think that will have impact on what we're seeing. But I also believe that we must identify folks that are hurt and figure out how to get services to them. And maybe that's the next step, is to say, okay, clearly this person has been through something, and you know, we see that they're elevating. They're getting into fist fights. They're getting into what I would call verbal arguments that threaten violence. There are things that are markers in someone's actions that will let you know that they have the potential to take a life.
That's why I think about the Think About It campaign. And I'm all for anything that even makes small progress. Mm. Absolutely. But as you said it yourself, the people who committed the murders that impacted your life, maybe a dozen just personally, mm-hmm. they knew the consequences. They knew what could
Absolutely.
Happen.
Absolutely. I think that there are folks who have glorified the fact that they can take a life in some of our communities. There are some folks who think that gives them some sense of credibility or respect. But I also think that there are some folks who are scared and don't think that they have another option. And so there's, you know, we used to have a saying, or at least when I was growing up, the worst person with a gun is a scared person. Because there's no telling who they may try to shoot. They may not even hit the intended target because they're scared. And so I just think that, you know, in terms of the Think About It campaign, I think it's a great idea, but we also have other measures that we can do. And I'm not talking about elected officials. I'm talking about people as a community. I think we're all given some sense of responsibility being elected in this community to do a number of things, and people don't read our charter. So we get a lot of stuff put on us that don't go along with the job.
What do you mean by that? What's an example?
I'll give you an example. Last night, we passed the the legislation that would sell land to the land bank for the homeless encampment. That is really something that the county should be doing. We don't deal with human services. The county does.
So council overstepped with that?
I wouldn't say that we overstepped. In the act of inaction by the county, we have to do something. So, you know, and it's not the first time that we've done something that was not really in our charter. But I think sometimes we get tasked with things because people don't know where else to turn.
All right, fair enough. Well, let me at least ask before we get really deeper on trauma, which I think is so core to this. I didn't hear any of your opponents in the primary for the Democratic congressional seat disagree with you. And I don't know that anyone, you know, sort of 100% disagrees with the construct you're saying, but I think there may be an argument that the law could have an impact on this by saying the laws we've created in this country have helped in sort of ensconce inequality, that we have inequality, that we have haves and have-nots, that the wealthiest have protected the wealthiest, and that as a result, partially because of a structure of laws, you have people who have less hope, have economic pain, and that some small percentage has turned to violence, and that over time, when there is one act of violence, of course, that trauma can impact other people. It impacts brothers and sisters and someone who survived a gunshot and their family, et cetera. And it sort of grows, but it starts with the law and inequality that gets sort of protected under the law, no?
I will say this. We shape and define violence, I would say, inadequately sometimes. There's violence throughout the entire system, whether you're rich, poor, black, white, old, young. And I'll give you an example. You got a president that's tweeting about war. What do you think war is? Violence. When you go to the movies to watch some of these action films, what is that? Violence. So I think sometimes we think that violence only hits in poor communities to people who don't have hope. That's not the issue. Matter of fact, I would say this. When we had the death penalty here in New York State, Rochester was facing its highest homicide rates of the time, 60 homicides in a year. We had the death penalty then. So when I think about laws, they don't have an impact in that sense, in terms of reducing who's doing the killing. I think you arrest people, you get them off the street, then a new batch of people come along and they commit a crime and the cycle continues. I kind of look at the issue of violence as something that we have glorified in a sense, but not treated it equally. So I'll give you an example. In Florida, they have the stand your ground rule, right? So you got a guy who approaches someone's woman sitting in a car. Matter of fact, she was threatened by the way that this guy approached. By their law, could she have stood her ground? Because here you have a man approaching a female over a parking space. Her boyfriend comes out, sees this guy, pushes him away.
Just shoved him, yeah.
Away from his woman, protecting his family. Turns his back and then turns around. Guy shoots him in the chest. Now, there are some people who will say that's okay. That's violence. See, we depict it differently depending on who the victim and who the perpetrator is. It is not something that is just happening in poor communities. It is not something just happening in urban areas. It is not something happening just in black communities. Blacks and whites are prone to commit the same levels of violence. Studies have shown that. But yet we define blacks when they do it as black on black crime as if there's not white on white crime. You're more likely to be killed by the people that you live amongst. And so I think sometimes we allow the definition of violence or what, is the problem based on who is the perpetrator and who is the victim.
I take that point. Crime rates tend to be higher in communities with more poverty, though. Fair?
I will say this. Reported crime rates are.
But you don't think actual crime rates?
I actually, it's not that. Okay. I just think that I've used to sit in courtrooms for fun. And what I mean by that is I went to town courts, I'm going to city courts, and seeing how they handle people of different backgrounds and different races. So I'll give you a prime example, drugs. There's a lot of studies that's been done on drugs. If blacks and whites use drugs at the same rates, why are there more African Americans in prison for drugs than there are whites?
I don't think there is any good answer. It's a racist system.
Right.
Yeah.
So so for me, it's not about whether it's prone to happen in areas of poverty more than areas of affluence. I just think that we have redefined, or at least defined it wrongly, as a problem of no hope and poverty. You think about the history of this country, specifically African Americans after slavery. We were impoverished over the entire United States. Did we have the death rates and murder rates that we have now? No. Did we have hope? Probably very little. Did we have education? Very little. So what has changed between now and then? We have access to more opportunities. We have a public education system. We have opportunities to be employed. So why is the homicide and murder rate increased a great deal between now and then?
What do you think the answer is?
I can tell you what the answer is. The proliferation of guns in our communities. Poor people, this is a funny fact for me. Poor people seem, everybody defines this as not having opportunity, not having access to all of this stuff, but how do they get access to guns? Somebody's got to answer that question. How do they get access to drugs? They don't have much, but they get access to this stuff. That's not by, happenstance, that's by design. How is it that we could have drugs and guns in communities of color and communities that are impoverished, especially after 9/11? Someone's got to answer that. We seem to have been able to stop a lot of people from coming into the country, but we haven't been able to stop drugs from coming into the country. So these are questions that we need to really sit back and think about, the fact that poor people have access to stuff that they didn't have access to when they, back in the 40s and 50s.
Well, that's why on the legislating side here, I mean, you didn't win your primary, but there's a lot of people in this town who expect to see you in future races, and feel free to break any news if you'd like right now.
Break any news? I'm relaxing and enjoying being back to myself.
So maybe you stay in Rochester, maybe you go to Albany, maybe you go to Washington someday, but you may have hands in state or federal legislation too. And the question becomes, if you don't think you can legislate your way out of it, but the presence of guns is a big part of the problem. Do we need aggressive laws? Would you ever favor confiscation? Would you ever favor people don't like the word confiscation, a buyback program?
Well, I've sponsored buyback programs in the past. You really don't get the guns that you really want to get.
How about
off
forced
the street?
Buyback? Mandatory buyback is kind of another word for confiscation.
I'm not there.
No?
What I would like for us to admit that there was a time that our government actually participated in giving guns to people in our community. I would like our government to admit that, just like I would like them to admit that they had a hand in drugs getting into our community. And if we could stop that and identify the folks that we gave the guns and drugs to, take back the guns and drugs, then I'd be okay with it. So that kind of confiscation, yeah.
Okay.
But not people who've gotten the stuff legally, no. But people who, there are stories all throughout the United States of people saying that they had guns delivered to their community into what I would call gang war zones. How is that? No one wants to deal with that answer, because it's scary to think that people would actually participate in something so devious.
Sinister?
Yeah. But it has happened.
Okay, Before we talk trauma, we're going to talk trauma in a moment. My guest is Adam McFadden, who is a member of Rochester City Council. And we're talking about violence in our community and valuing life. And the number to call if you want to join the conversation is 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. Trauma and trauma-informed care are still terms that are, I guess, relatively new. I mean, and certainly new or unknown to too many people, I think you feel like. So let's start with how we address trauma. How do we do it?
Well, one, we have to identify what has happened in people's lives. I think right now the school district is attempting to do that with young people. They have ways to identify that with reports like the DESA, where they go through and they look at, you know, certain indicators. It's a short form, and once you get through that form, it determines whether or not you need to go to a more extensive form. I'm not sure that there's a way to do that for adults who don't want to participate in that type of questioning or, you know, survey. But most of us know, I would say this, most of us know what we've survived and what we have gone through and whether or not it's had an impact on us. Now, whether or not we're willing to share that is a whole, you know, a whole nother thing. But I think we have to figure out how to make safe places or safe space for folks who want to share their trauma to deal with it.
Do you believe in the stereotype that men have a harder time talking about their trauma than women?
I don't know. I don't have a problem talking about mine. So I don't.
But was that always the case? Because you said you got shot in the leg. How old were you?
Oh, 15.
I mean, was that always the case for you? Were you always able to share it? Was there a moment in your life where things started to turn?
I think as I began to mature as a young man, that I began to accept some things instead of complaining about them and just say, hey, this is what my experience was, but I won't allow it to define me. So I'll give you another example. I was the man of my mother's house since I was like 8 or 9 years old. I have 4 siblings who are younger than me. My mother was a single mother who worked on and off in my childhood. So sometimes we were on the system and sometimes we weren't. But in that house, I had the responsibility of being a dad to 4 brothers. And so my childhood was not the normal childhood. And some of that has defined me to this day so much. In fact, if you see my brothers interact with me, they treat me more like a father than they do a big brother, just because of the relationship that I have with them growing up. And I had to discipline them. They had to follow my rules. And I wasn't a 10-year-old kid. So how would I know what the rules were? You know, I did what my mother told me to do and I passed it along. And some of that has even defined me in positive and negative ways. I can be a bit controlling. I know that about myself because of how I was expected to conduct myself, but also be responsible for my brother's actions, which meant that I had to control their actions because I would be disciplined on, you know, whatever they did. So just knowing enough about myself has allowed me to control my own personal skeletons or demons, to be honest with you. So I have no problem talking about that. My mother doesn't like me to talk about it, but I have no problem talking about it.
I see the phone ringing. We're going to get to that in a second. Michael in Penfield wants to ask Adam. Michael says, who is delivering the guns to these communities? And if Adam knows, he should tell us.
It's not that I know like it's one particular one particular person, but I can tell you this. In some neighborhoods, and I give you a prime example. The police had a kid that was about 17 or 18 years old. This is going back maybe a decade now, who sold an undercover officer a gun. And then he was allowed to do 38 other transactions. 38. So he sold 38 different guns to undercover officers. But they never uncovered where he got the gun from, where he was getting the guns from. So think about this. A 17-year-old kid had a connection to someone that anytime someone needed a gun, they go to his kid. But who was he getting the guns from? At 17, could you go get an endless supply of guns?
Well, certainly not.
I couldn't even do that, and I had some street credibility. So I'm just saying, they're not like now we have a number of guns that are on the street because they were stolen. But we also have a number of guns that are on the street that came from somewhere that we have not really identified how they've gotten there.
And you see something possibly sinister in that?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Intentional as a way to harm certain communities?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
I really believe that.
When do you see sort of the dividing line and when that started to ramp up and change?
I think when you look at the mid-'80s, before what I would call the drug war era on the streets, there were no guns in our community.
Not like today? Nothing close today?
Absolutely not. To see a gun meant that somebody's father had a gun legally in the house. It wasn't, you know, anybody could just get one. I had a couple corner stores in my district that would sell guns to people.
But when you were growing up, if you saw a gun, it meant the father had a gun in the house.
Somebody in the house legally had a gun. It wasn't just anybody could have one. Today, anybody could have one.
Let's get a couple of phone calls in. This is Andrew in Irondequoit. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hey, Adam, how are you?
Go ahead again, Andrew. He's got the headphones on. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, you were just hitting on the topic of fatherhood a little bit. How did your brothers do? You say a father figure to them. Sounds like you were a pretty good father figure to them. How did they turn out?
Well, I'll say this. I failed miserably.
Oh.
No, I mean, they're doing fine today, but two of them had a rough patch.
Okay.
And that patch actually happened when I went off to college. And that's how I ended up back in Rochester. My purpose, at least when I graduated from college, was either to go to grad school or go work in Washington, D.C.
Uh-huh.
But I had a brother that was actually on trial for a crime. Mm-hmm. And I decided I would come back and make sure that the youngest two would be okay, and that happened. So.
Well, way back in the 60s, Hubert Humphrey used to talk about the breakup of the family.
Yep.
And he would sound like a conservative Republican today, apparently. But I think that's the root of a lot of the issue you're talking about, is getting back to the basics of you know what I tell people? I tell people your college education is watching, or not, is watching your dad go to work every day when you're growing up.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's all. I you know, hope you can solve this problem, but that's all I got to say.
Andrew, thanks for the phone call. Do you generally agree there?
Oh, absolutely. I think that the moment that our economy changed to the point that two people had to work to make ends meet, was the destruction of a lot of families, whether you're white or black. Remember, the American dream used to consist of one parent working and another parent being home nurturing the kids and kind of making sure everything was okay. The system we have now, both parents pretty much work and the schools are watching the kids, to be honest with you.
So what is going to be something that is a catalyst for change in our community? I'd see more fathers involved.
I think that's part of it, but also you got to remember, we would have fathers who weren't raised by fathers now too. So I mean, you know, being a father isn't just about producing a child or you know, being around here and there. For me, I'm a protector and defender of my kids almost to a fault. If someone wanted to hurt me, that's how they could hurt me. There's not many things that would hurt me, but my children, messing with them, that would be that would be the end of my career probably. I think that by fault, I've actually become the father to many kids in the community. And even in my, you know, I have a blended family now with, you know, six girls. So for me, my most important job is being there for them every day as much as I can.
But let me just be blunt, because when you do 500 hours of talk radio a year, you hear a lot of different viewpoints on what could improve the community. And there are some people who I would probably say generally are, and I'm not saying this pejoratively, I'm just observing, white suburban listeners who probably don't spend a lot of time in different communities. And the first thing you often hear is, well, where are the black families? Where's the...
Well, I can tell you what happened to the black families. We lost a sense of a community when we began to have social programs that required that the man not be in the home. I mean, people forget the history of social services in the 60s and 70s that basically forced men out of the house in black communities. And so men couldn't be in the house with their families if social services were provided. And I can remember my mother's social worker coming to the house on surprise visits, doing a check of what was physically in the house to say, you know, were you receiving a subsidy and not using it correctly? I remember that as a child. And so part of it was that. The other part of it was we just had some irresponsible men also who got caught up into making babies all over the place and not taking care of them. We have to be honest about what the situation is. Even with my own dad, which he and I struggled with a relationship as, you know, as I was a young person. But when I became older, he was a great grandfather to my children. But he was not, you know, available for me emotionally, financially, mentally at all. And so I just, we have to basically be honest about what caused that. We have some irresponsible men, you know, at a certain point in time that did not see themselves having a role with the women that they were making children with. And this is not just black people. This is a bunch of folks. But we also had a system that said if you needed help, then a man could not be in the house. And so those two things have become a problem. And now you look at what's going to happen to, like, my girls in terms of the education system. When you look at the lack of black male achievement academically, when my kids go off to college, matter of fact, my daughter is going in a couple of weeks. Her school is 9-1 female to male. Black female to black male, 9-1. So she comes back from college, and because she's heterosexual, who does she start a family with? 9-1 is the ratio of her school. And that's a real conversation that we need to have. Because if you're achieving professionally, do you go backwards and pick a guy that struggled in high school, didn't go to college, may work here and there? That's not the future I picture for my daughter, but she could possibly fall in love with a person like that.
But she's not feeling options.
Right. Okay. So we have things that we have to look at in terms of, you know, we had a system where we had some irresponsibility going on. We have to accept that. But we also had some social issues going on with the structure
Yes.
of social services at the same time that has caused us to have this loss of male leadership in the home.
I think it's a complex answer. And I think one of the reasons that Adam is viewed as someone who bridges a lot of divides, I know you take grief from some people, but I view you as someone who bridges divides.
Only way to avoid criticism is to do nothing. So.
Yeah, it's fair. It's a complex and difficult answer. Andrew, thank you for the phone call. We have a bunch of other phone calls to work through. We're late for our only break. Let's take it now. We'll come back to more of your phone calls for a member of Rochester City Council, Adam McFadden. Coming up in our second hour, doctors and empathy. Can you teach someone empathy? Well, locally, medical students are working with actors who are putting themselves into roles in which the doctors have to deliver rough news, a cancer diagnosis, sometimes terminal. What should doctors say? What shouldn't they say? Have you been there yourself? How have the doctors done? We'll discuss empathy next hour. Welcome back to Connections. Adam McFadden is my guest. Scott in Prattsburg is on the phone next. Go ahead, Scott.
Thank you, Evan. I caught that white suburban. Well, Prattsburg is more like white country. Sorry about that, but I had to make that point. But I must share, Adam, I think you really hit the nail on the head. And I'm hearing some very overlapping layers here with the core of the issues and how it relates to core values and education and the awareness of that. And all of these things, I think, come into play. And when you're talking about kids, from the experience I've seen, you know, working with kids, they're like cameras. They see everything. And they're always interpreting, they're always looking, they're always watching, and they role model. And believe it or not, the brain doesn't even fully develop until they're like, I'm still working on mine, but I think it's like 21, 22. So this is, you know, it's a learning process, and they become wired that way. And it's a lot of work to help change, but it goes right back and overlaps to the core and core values in education. And one other point, I think you'll appreciate this. My faculty advisor over at the U of R was doing a qualitative research, and her research was on the checkout counter and watching and listing the things that people were buying as they're coming through. What do you think the mainframe was? Beer. Mm. And, you know, well, now this is qualitative research, so you can go a little further than just numbers. Well, why are they buying beer? Well, because it's coping. They're coping with the issues of poverty. And more than one person told her that. Well, hello, look at what we're talking about here with drugs. It's all related. And I really think, Adam, if there's any way to help push the education, the awareness, and let people know why it's happening, I think you'd see a lot of reasons for going besides just taking all the guns. It's not the guns that are killing people, it's the people behind them. Why? And I think that's the theme. Thanks for listening.
Scott, thanks for the phone call. Go ahead, Adam. What do you think?
Well, I think he made some good points there. And I do think we have a lot of people self-medicating, whether it's alcohol or recreational drugs. I do think we have a number of people dealing with their trauma that way.
Let me get one more phone call, and then I've got a pile of emails as well. You've touched a nerve today, Adam. Eloise in Rochester. Go ahead, Eloise.
Hi, Adam.
Hello.
Thank you for what you're doing. I'm from a life of trauma, and I worked hard. I spent all my money years ago to heal many, many phobias. And the problem with the guns can start with school. I ended up in foster homes where I was abused and then abused by school teachers. I was a student that loved learning. I was close to a straight A student, and I had this horrible teacher who gave me all F's in place of my A's when I transferred to another school. And I got to a point where I blocked out my first 12 years. But at the same time, Adam, I'm very, very gifted with young children. And I mean, I have worked in daycares, and hearing somebody say, a 10-month-old is going to go nowhere. Mm. Well, their minds are like, they know now, like hypnosis the first 8 years. So what you're locking in there, and then we have to, when teachers aren't believing, I've reached the unreachable children almost in no time. There were some that was very difficult, but by taking on the problem and not throwing it away, I was gaining more wisdom. And I want people to know that the real gold is not sending away that little child. Because, you know, when you're not believing in the child, and I don't know how many teachers are sitting in the teacher's room and deciding that the child can't do it because of something that's going on at home. Mm. And my care, it was my problem. And I was with 23 children once, and I reached them all. Because you know what I did? I went in, I said, what am I going to do? I said, everyone will believe they're my favorite.
Eloise, let me just ask Adam to respond to some of this. Thank you for the phone call. Because, Adam, when it comes to the question of telling students or assuming students are going nowhere, that they don't have a chance, Eloise experienced that. She witnessed that. But she believes that, you know, you can still pull people forward who've been traumatized in different ways.
I actually had a similar experience at School 41 in the sixth grade with a teacher there who was what I would define as old school racist. My brothers and I had been bussed into a school that was predominantly white at the time. I was supposed to be in what they call their MAP program back then. And this teacher did everything possible to break my spirit and every black boy that was in that class. And it's funny, when I run into a couple of them, we actually sit and talk about those things that were either said or done to us that were just horrible. But at the same time, I got to 10th grade and had a teacher who was the exact opposite. And a lot of my ways are very similar to his ways, because I took to him so much that I wanted to be him. And I just think about what he put into me. What that one teacher took out of me, he put into me and made me see how special I was. He made me feel like I could do anything. He made me accountable for my actions, but also spoke life into me even when I was not doing my best.
So in terms of not being able to legislate our way out of trauma, can we add more pre-K services, more early intervention, stuff like that?
There are a number of things that we can do, but we have to all realize that we all play a part into the fixing of people. And what I mean by that is, if you take school, for example, school is not only about teachers and students. It's about the bus driver. It's about the lunch lady. It's about the hall monitor. It's about the secretary in the office. If all of those people touched every child in a way that made them feel good about themselves, we would not be experiencing some of the things that we experience now. The issue is, people don't see themselves as a collective. They just do their job. So that good morning, or you look nice, or you're very smart, that was a good decision. Those little things go a long way. I remember my child is 18, and I can't wait till I see this guy, because I see him, you know, every now and then. She was having a really bad day, and we go through the drive-thru. And he goes, "Honey, you're so beautiful." Now, mind you, I tell my kid that all the time. It doesn't mean much. When he said it, I saw her whole attitude change for the rest of the day. If I could find that guy, I'm going to shake his hand, because that she was really having a bad day. But that one thing that he said to her changed it. Changed it. And people have to realize that those minor interactions that we take for granted can mean everything to a person. I can remember being in the ninth grade. I was in a class full of what I would call degenerates, guys that were older than me. Some of them were in gangs. So all I did was do my work. I was trying not to be seen. And I remember my English teacher coming up to me and said, "Adam, you work really hard. You're very smart." And all I could remember is wanting to do even more after he told me that. And in all actuality, I was only doing that because I was trying to shrink in the classroom. I was trying not to be seen by these 11th grade guys that were taller, bigger, stronger, and tougher than I was. So I just decided I would do my work. And when he said that to me, I worked even harder.
You're like, I better validate this?
Yeah.
Thank you for the phone call. And Adam, you know, powerful stuff for us to think about, our interactions with people. Let me get a couple of emails real quick. Edward says, Councilman McFadden, there are at least 1,200 people living in the city of Rochester who are currently under parole supervision and through the New York State Department of Corrections and Community Supervision. Do you think parole supervision is helping or hurting in reducing violence in the community? Do you think it could be possible for parole officers to help parolees overcome trauma?
Well, I'll put it this way. Do I think it's possible? Yes. Do I think currently? No, because of their work. They're, between parole and probation, I've seen what their workloads are in terms of their cases, the people they have to monitor. We don't have enough officers. And so their interactions with people are very short because of the amount of cases that they're involved with. So we definitely have an issue there. Do I think that they could play a part? Yes. But I think some of them have to be tough with people because we're dealing with some people who have, experienced some things and they're back in our community and they need to be monitored. I'm not one of these people that think, hey, you got to get rid of that system. No, that system is there for a reason. And so do I think they could help with that? Yes. But currently, no, just because of their case and workload. They have a lot that they deal with. I have a lot of respect for them because they deal with a lot. And they're not compensated or recognized the way that they should be.
Let me read Nancy's email. She says, there is ample evidence that guns and drugs, especially, were purposefully brought into communities of color. Michelle Alexander's book on the new Jim Crow makes the case very clearly.
Yes.
What can Mr. McFadden help us understand about how this might still be the case today or is continuing to influence our community? She also goes on to say this. Also, what about economic injustice and violence? Rochester is incredibly segregated economically, and as a result of societal racism, racially, this is not an accident. So knowing the history and the current conditions, how does the councilman think remedies can be pursued?
If I had the answers to that, I'd probably be some national scholar on this issue. I think we all recognize the problems. At least I recognize the problems as this person that emailed you has. I think we're all trying to chip away at some of this. The one thing that I believe is the equalizer to economic injustice is education. The further you go in your education, the more opportunities you have career-wise, the more opportunity you have to make money, the more opportunities you have to start a business. I just think, to me, that is the baseline. We have to make sure that not only that people are graduating from high school, but they're excelling in education. Because the last time I checked, if you're an engineer, nobody's thinking whether you're a black or white engineer. They're thinking, hey, we need you. Last time I checked, if you're a doctor, a surgeon, no one's saying, hey, he's a black surgeon. They're just saying he's a surgeon. We have to stop making excuses about education and get really tough about the fact that we should be pushing all our children to excel. I get frustrated by attempts to lower the floor versus raising the ceiling. Because I believe if you give people the tools and you raise the expectation and you put the hope in them and you put the energy into them, they'll try to meet them.
Well, just in terms of education, we only have 2 minutes left here. We had an hour-long conversation with the State Commissioner of Education, Mary Ellen Elia. That hour-long conversation is going to air this coming Tuesday on this program. And, of course, she's been here in Rochester for a few days talking about the distinguished educator that she appointed to help oversee and make change in the Rochester City School District. Thoughts on that?
Joke. It's my thought on it as a joke. You have an elected school board who makes decisions. You have, and they made a decision on a superintendent, and they have to trust that they made the right decision and they work together. We keep trying to find a Superman to fix decades of destruction. That's not going to work. Just like their rules for, closing a school. It hasn't worked for us. We're not fixing anything. So I'm really frustrated by her leadership, and that's just me. Because I just think that, these things are done for news headlines and not for our children. What's best for our children is consistency. What's best for our children is love. What's best for our children is making sure they have the resources available to them. and making sure that we're putting everything we can into that. We don't need a distinguished educator to tell us that.
Down to our last 40 seconds, then what does the city school district need most right now?
Right now, they need an individual success plan for every kid that involves parent and teacher cooperation with expectations that are set by both.
Could be a heavy lift. A lot of.
I don't think so. If you get a parent and a teacher and a student all on the same page and they know the expectations and they have roles and responsibilities and they adhere to it, that's not a heavy lift.
And that can include attendance, grades, activities.
What they do in the home, what's needed outside the classroom, what is expected inside the classroom, very simple stuff. We try to put so much on our children that we forgot the very basics of education. And we need to get back to that.
But not a fan of the distinguished educator.
Not at all.
I wonder what you really feel about it. When the show's over, you can tell us. Adam McFadden is a member of Rochester City Council, and he never minces words, and one of the most accessible people in our local government structure, and I always appreciate that. Thanks for coming in. Really appreciate seeing you again. All right, much more connections coming up.